Well, good morning.
Good morning.
Okay. We are in the book of Acts, and it's a long book, 28 chapters. Big picture, before we jump into chapter 18, we're almost two-thirds of the way through. Book of Acts, big picture, is the story of the first 30 years of the Christian faith. Luke takes about roughly the first third of the book to talk about what the faith was like before Paul. And so this is with Peter and John and Philip and who's the guy that got killed? Stephen? Yeah, all those wonderful stories. Yeah. There's a moral lesson in that for those who work in the church. Okay, yeah. Many. He wasn't the last to die, by the way. Well, yeah, it's true. And then what Luke then does, he turns to his great hero, Paul. And we have the story of Paul's conversion, and then Paul goes up to the back to his home for a while. Things, wonderful things happen up at Antioch. Barnabas pulls Paul over. They have what's called the first of the four missionary journeys, which is Cyprus and Asia Minor, southern part of that, which is known as Galatia. They come back. Turns out that's a big brouhaha because they have converted people to the from Gentiles into the Christian faith, and they're not requiring them to be Jewish. And then we have the Council at Jerusalem, and then we have the incident at Antioch, and there's a kind of a falling out. Paul heads west, new territory. And the second missionary journey, the first by himself, but Paul's second journey, he's going to hit Philippi, he's going to hit Thessaloniki, he then hits Athens, and then today he's going to hit Corinth. And we're going to kind of end the first journey today, and then next week we will be at Ephesus. So, any of y'all been to Corinth? Any of y'all been? Corinth, Texas, where are you going? Okay, moment of truth. Who remembers the camp that we had at Corinth, Texas? Lake Sharon, okay. So some of us, yeah, Jane's with us now, yeah. We sold it, yeah. You know, they had a $3 million deal against it if that dam had fallen and stuff. So, Corinth, interesting place. Think Vegas. Yeah. Think Mobile, Alabama when the Navy's in. Years ago, I was on a mission trip with our youth group, not here, but at White Rock, and we were in Mobile, Alabama, and it was choir tour, and the choir director said, well, let's just turn the kids loose in the town. And we had three ex-Navy people who just locked the door and said, no. We don't do that. Corinth is a fascinating place. It was a raucous place, kind of an anything-goes place, major metropolitan area, crossroads right there between the east and west. And so Paul has been to Athens. He's going to work himself down, and we're going to pick up a fascinating story. After this, Paul left Athens. Athens is interesting for this reason. It's the only place we know that Paul ever went. He was not forced to leave. So it just says, you remember they were they wanted to debate some more, and Paul just says, nah, I don't think so. He leaves. So he goes down, he crosses the isthmus there down the Peloponnese to Corinth. There he found a Jew, big city. I'm assuming within a Jewish community you're gonna network, named Aquila, a native of Pontus up in Asia Minor up there, kind of north of Galatia, who had recently come from Italy with his wife, Priscilla, sometimes referred to as Prisca. She can be referred to both ways. Why was he there? Because Claudius, remember him? Not one of the nicer Roman emperors, had ordered all Jews to leave Rome. We actually have historical verification of this. Now, the expulsion of the Jews is an interesting little historical factoid. Because here's what we know. In 49 AD, the Emperor Claudius had expelled the Jews from Rome. Suetonius, one of the very famous Roman historians, gives us an additional clue, so I thought you might kind of enjoy this. This is what he said. This is from the Lives of the 12 Caesars. Claudius expelled the Jews from Rome since they rioted constantly. You can't have that. You kick them out. Okay. Here's where it gets interesting. At the instigation of Christus. Now, there's a lot of ink been spilled over this, okay? Now, historically, most scholars think he probably did not expel all 40,000 Jews in Rome. There's more Jews in Rome than there was in Jerusalem, by far. far more likely that this refers to an expulsion of troublemakers, likely in a particular synagogue. That makes more sense. And they're arguing over this Christus. If it's a reference to Christ, which a lot of, probably the majority of scholars think this is likely what this is about, it means you've got a group of Jews kicked out of Rome because in a local synagogue they're fighting and fussing over Christ. Make sense? Which would have meant that some kind of an evangelist, this is pre-Paul, Paul has not been to Rome, some evangelist other than Paul went to Rome, proclaimed the faith in a particular synagogue. Some people have accepted the message, some people have not, and that results in what? Well, my grandpa called a brouhaha. Okay. Now, what's interesting today is that we're going to see, this is exactly the story we're going to see in Corinth. What happened, what's described, Suetonius said happened in Rome, where actually Luke's going to walk us through basically the same thing happening in Corinth. And it's also here connected with Paul's ministry because it happens after he arrived. Now, this would explain why Priscilla and Aquila were kicked out of Rome. It means that they are already Christian, and they were among the people stirring things up. In other words, they were probably evangelists. A lot of scholars comment on the point that it's interesting that Priscilla is mentioned before Aquila, because in this culture, that carries some specific meaning. Remember that? Remember it's Barnabas and Paul? And when you put Barnabas' name first, what do you say? He's the primary. Okay, he's the lead guy. That would make who the primary? Priscilla. Okay. Which fits with Paul's ministries, you know. They had been in Rome. They're now in Corinth. And significantly, they are there before Paul arrives. So we've got Christians. This is what we're the backstory. We've got Christians in Rome pre-Paul. And we've got Christians in Corinth pre-Paul. Isn't that interesting? We tend to think that Paul's the one that spread the faith around. But do you remember that Pentecost, 3,000 were converted, 3,000, and one of the cities that was named was Rome, and one of the cities that was named was Corinth. And then later we have Stephen's stoning, and again we're told a second wave goes out, and those apparently stayed more in the east. So this means that when Paul arrives, there's already a church there, probably in a synagogue, and it's a pre-Pauline form of the faith. That's important because of what happens next. Now, since Suetonius says in Rome, we're going to now see the story here, what's going to happen. The controversy over Christ is going to result in some getting kicked out of the synagogue, and with them, Paul, true to his personality, will get kicked out with them. So, we have a little story here about Priscilla and Aquila. Paul went to see them, and because he was of the same trade, what were we told that he was? Tent maker. Probably not accurate. It's like saying when Jesus is a tecton, saying he's a carpenter is probably more working with stone, but construction. The trade here is leather work. And most tents were made of leather. You know, canvas was not readily available. So Paul went to him because he was of the same trade. And we get some interesting stuff here. He stays with them. They work together. By trade, they were tent makers or leather workers. Now, what appears to be happening is Priscilla and Aquila are a wealthy business couple running a small business in the town there. They are working in the leather trade. Paul apparently is of that trade also, independent of them. Probably where he picked that up in Tarsus, where he is from. Now, in both, nothing that Luke tells us is interesting, and Paul does too, is that in both Rome and Ephesus, the church meets in their house. Does that tell you something about their economic status? Okay. The house is big enough that the church can meet there. And we're not talking large, but, you know, 15, 20, maybe 30 people. In Corinth, the church meets at someone else's house, which is interesting. The comment they work together implies probably that Paul is their employee. They're there, they're established, they're running a business. Paul's of the same trade. They share a lot in common. They share a trade, and they also share the Christian faith. Most likely, under the Roman system, they're probably his patrons. They take him in. They support him. If they have been missionaries and they realize that he's a missionary, they would want to support his ministry. So they support him in the ministry financially. And again, the patronage model is very, very common in the Roman world, basically. So Paul also lived with them. Now, you probably, anybody been to Pompeii? Or Herodium, or the way that they worked this was interesting in all Roman cities. The bottom floor is your businesses, restaurants, whatever it is. And where do the folks who run the business live? Upstairs. Overhead, yeah. And that's probably what Luke is describing, is that probably there's the bottom floor is the business, the leather shop. And so they live upstairs. And so Paul would live up with them. He would work downstairs with him, and then he would probably go to the synagogue on the Saturday. And by the way, a lot of recent scholarship says that we think there's a good reason to believe that if you're sitting there in a leather shop, and there's no glass doors, by the way, it's just open, and you're working there all day, and people are walking by, what's this perfect opportunity for evangelists, you know? Strike up a little conversation. And so it's not all necessarily in that. So there's a good chance that this would be a wonderful chance for that. So Paul confirms this relationship and adds that they also worked with him in his ministry. So he works with them in their business. They work with him in the ministry. Now, they probably also had their own ministry. Otherwise, they probably would have still been in Rome. Paul will tell us that later they returned to Rome, because later, this is years later, as Paul writes in Romans, this is what he says. Greet Prisca and Aquila. So apparently they were in Rome. They got kicked out of Rome. They went to Corinth. They lived there for a while. But we know that the emperor then allowed the Jews to come back, and it looks like they came back, who work with me in Jesus Christ and who risked their necks for my life. And we have a story in Corinth that fits with. To whom not only I give thanks, but also to all the churches of the Gentiles. By the way, what kind of churches are these? Non-Jew, Gentile churches. Paul's consistent with that. So, now, we get this wonderful story of the founding of the church at Corinth. Well, it's sort of a misnomer. There is a church there already, and it's probably in a synagogue, courtesy of Priscilla and Aquila. Paul joins them, and things go south. Anybody surprised? But what we're going to result is this is going to be a schism where some people are going to leave the synagogue and then set up a church outside the synagogue. So every Sabbath, he would argue in the synagogue. Remember that's Luke? Somebody the other day said, that's just kind of unfair to Paul. But, you know, this is Paul we're talking about. Okay. He would try to convince the Jews and the Greeks. That's Luke's version. When Silas and Timothy arrived from Macedonia, so they have been come over now, join him. So now we got Priscilla, Aquila, Paul, Silas, and Timothy. We've got a good work group there. Paul was occupied with proclaiming the word, testifying to the Jews that Jesus, the Messiah, was Jesus. Again, this is Luke's approach to this. When they opposed and reviled him in protest, he shook off the dust from his clothes. By the way, that's an interesting thing. Do you remember where else that statement is made?
Jesus.
Very rarely does Paul quote, are there references back to the ministry of Jesus. Of course, this is Luke, but this is one of them. This is a reference to what Jesus told his disciples and said to them, your blood be on your own heads, I am innocent. Now I will go to the Gentiles. So this big dramatic moment. He's in the synagogue. The Jews say, out with Paul. And he makes this big turn. I'm going to leave you and I'm going to go to the Gentiles. So he left the synagogue and went to the house of the man named Titius Justus, a worshiper of God. So he's a what? Gentile? He's a Gentile theosobon worshiper. The house was next door to the synagogue. Oh, there you go. We're going to set up the competition just right next door, okay? Crispus, the official of the synagogue, became a believer in the Lord. Hang on to his name, together with all of his household, because in Roman society, once the head of the household makes a decision, who's involved in that decision? It's a blanket deal. So if I become a Christian, my family, my slaves, my servants, everybody's involved in that. And many of the Corinthians who heard Paul became believers and were baptized. So Luke's indicating that we have a pretty sizable group. Now, in 1 Thessalonians, which is written when Paul's in Corinth, he confirms that Timothy and Silas were with him in Corinth, because we have this little statement. From Paul, Silvanus, and Timothy to the church of the Thessalonians who are with God. So this is Paul confirming a piece of his story. Now, one of the fascinating things about Corinth is at Corinth, we have the fullest, richest, most complete account of the founding of any church in the first 300 years of the church's existence. Because we have it mentioned here in Acts, and Paul also mentions it in 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians. Or 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians are about that church. So we have this wonderful, rich material. It's from 1 and 2 Corinthians that you learn that the church at Corinth had a few issues. It was a troubled church. So in Acts, this is what Luke wants to tell us. Paul is rejected by the Jews of the synagogue. He turns to Gentiles. That is, we know, Lucan theology. Here's Luke's basic point. Paul goes to the Jews. The Jews reject Paul. Paul turns to Gentiles. What do the Gentiles do? They love him, and they join in large numbers. And that's sort of the story that Luke repeats over and over again. So Luke is going to repeat this dramatic turning point three times in Acts. So three times in Acts, Paul's going to be working with the Jews, and they don't want to hear it, so he dramatically turns to the Gentiles. Now, you know this, some of you already, but in Paul's letters, there's never a single hint that he ever was interested in working with Jews. Matter of fact, all the evidence goes exactly there. So historically, this rejection by the Jews, which would be and some Jewish Christians, had happened actually before. But for Luke, and remember, Luke is writing to Gentiles. He's not writing to Jews. And he's writing a Paul is writing here probably in the early 50s. And Luke is written in the 80s. So enough time has gone back that Luke is looking back on this time frame. So he's not immediately in that. What Luke sees that did happen historically, he brings that into Paul's ministry as sort of a paradigm so that everywhere Paul goes, that happens over and over and over. Paul's view is he was an apostle of Gentiles in the beginning. It's not something that he shifts to after the Jews have elected him. So remember this in Galatians. I have been trusted with the gospel of the Gentiles. Yeah. Do you remember what the next verse was? Peter was given the gospel to the Jews. You know, that's not his area of expertise. Romans, I am an apostle to the Gentiles. In all Paul's letters, we get this kind of idea. Now, the house of Titius Justus. What Luke is describing is we have the brouhaha in the synagogue. It results in a schism. And so it splits, and some people go next door. The church probably is made up of Gentile God-fearers. Yes, there could be some Jews in that. For example, Priscilla and Aquila are likely part of this, and they're Jewish. Crispus is likely a Jew. The interesting thing about the description, Crispus is described as the head of the synagogue. The term in Greek is arch-synagogos, which means he's the president of the synagogue. Is that a little bit of a scandal? The head guy of the synagogue walks out with Paul to form the rival group next door. Crispus becomes a believer. Paul confirms this in his letter to the church, written probably a year or so after this, because in Corinthians, Paul says this, I thank God that I baptized none of you, because it'd be something else you could argue over. Except I did baptize two people, Crispus and Gallius. So Corinth will now become the headquarters of an independent Gentile mission. As far as we know, this is the first sort of... He started a church at Philippi. There's a third church at Berea. There's a church at Thessaloniki. But this seems to be a little bit different. This kind of becomes a base of operations that Paul's going to operate on. A little later, Ephesus will become that. We'll get to that next week. Paul's going to spend 18 months in Corinth. He's not traveling all the time. Corinth's a big city. And are there lots of opportunities for the gospel there? There's some people who maybe need to hear the gospel, including people in the church. This will be his second longest stay anywhere. Then we have this wonderful story of Paul having a night vision. Now, when I have a night vision, what do we call those?
Nightmares.
Depends on the content, yeah. A dream. But a night vision or a dream. But because visions in the ancient world came from whom? Came from God. So a night vision is a night, a deal from God. So the idea here is it's from God. So one night the Lord said to Paul in a vision, Do not be afraid, but speak, and do not be silent. I don't think Paul was ever afraid to do that, but yeah, I'm just going to go with that. For I am with you, and no one will lay a hand on you to harm you. So it's a very this would not be a nightmare. This is sort of reassuring. More dreams like this, less dreams like the other, okay? For there are many in this city who are my people. That's interesting. There are many in this people in this city. This is told in such a way that maybe Paul needed to hear it, so maybe Paul doesn't know it, which can indicate that there may have been other Christian congregations in Corinth other than the one Paul was working with. When Paul writes to Romans, he mentions five churches in Rome that are all Christian, but they're somewhat related to each other, but independent. And so we may have an example of that here. Paul stayed there a year and 6 months. That's the dating we get, teaching the word of God among them. Now, Luke tells us repeatedly that Paul is a visionary mystic. And you probably remember some of this. Remember Paul's conversion on the road to Damascus? I have seen the Lord. It's a vision. Then remember he has this, he's wandering around the Asia Minor, not sure where to go, and he has a vision. The Macedonian man says, come over to Macedonia and help us. And now in Corinth once again. Good. So that's Luke's depiction. Well, it turns out that this fits with Paul. Paul tells us, in fact, he is a visionary mystic. And one of the most remarkable stories is told in 2 Corinthians. The time frame that he gives us here probably means that it happened during the time he was at Antioch with Barnabas. But Paul is reflecting back, and wonderful story here. I know a person, that this is Roman writing style. If I know a person, who am I talking about? Me, yeah. Just a little false modesty. I know a person in Christ who, okay, 14 years ago, that's going to put him at Antioch with Barnabas, was caught up into the third heaven. Okay, do y'all know the heavens? Middle Ages, there'll be seven. In this time frame, the first heaven is where the birds are. The second heaven is where the planets and the stars are. And the third heaven would be where who is? God. Caught up into the third heaven. Whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know. Classic mystical out-of-body experience. Any of y'all, I've had one of those my entire life. Any of y'all had one of those? Scares the willies out of you. You know. But yeah, there's points where you feel like you've stepped outside your body and you're kind of looking at that. So Paul's having one of those. I know such a person. Now, this is Hebraic, so we're going to say the same thing again in different words. Whether in the body or out of the body, I do not know. Only God knows. I was caught up into paradise. Who's in paradise? God. So it's the third heavens. In other words, caught up into paradise and heard things that are not to be told. I could tell you, but I'm not going to do it. Okay. No mortal is permitted to repeat. Again, just what he's describing here is exactly the kind of thing that Luke's talking about. Paul was a visionary mystic, and Luke gets that right. So Paul then goes before Galileo, and this becomes really interesting because of this. This is an archaeological discovery. It's one of the great archaeological discoveries in the ancient world. This piece of granite enables us to date the ministry of Paul and all of its details. So this is worth saying. When Galileo was proconsul of Achaia, now, this again is one of the very few firm historical, matter of fact, it's maybe the only firm historical anchor that we have that everybody would agree on. Galileo, we know, was proconsul in 1 year, 52. He didn't last long. So if we're going to date something to when Gaia was a proconsul, we've got an anchor. We can anchor this historically. You got Mano Greek? Okay, Greek scholars? Okay, those of you who went to college and you were in the Greek society. G-A-L-L-O. And the date there tied to a particular Roman historian. So really rock solid archaeology there. Working with that anchor, we can go backwards and forwards. We can establish a timeline for Paul's life and ministry. So it's off this that we pretty much date everything that's in Paul's life, which is a wonderful thing. Now, Paul goes before Gallio. When Gallio was proconsul of Achaia, the Jews made a united attack on Paul, again, the Lucan deal. Well, you know, this wouldn't have to be Luke, because if Paul went after the God-fearers, that would get you in trouble with the synagogue. They brought him before the tribunal. So the backstory here is we're going to haul him before Rome. Does that remind you of another story? Later in the last third of Acts, Luke gives this long, and it's called the Passion of Paul. And basically, he parallels what happens to Paul with what happened to Jesus kind of thing. Maybe a little bit of it here, I'm not sure. But here's the charge. This man is persuading people to worship God in ways that are contrary to the law. We've seen that before. We've seen that once before. Just as Paul is about to speak, now, who is the only person who has the right to interrupt Paul? Gallio, the governor, you know, said to the Jews, if it were a matter of crime or serious villainy, which you're accusing him of, I would be justified in accepting the complaint that you have against him. But since it seems to be a matter of questions and words and names about your own law, this seems to be an internecine Jewish squabble, see to it yourselves. I do not wish to be a judge of these matters. That's actually a pretty wise counsel. You know, you guys fussing and feuding over stuff I don't understand. And by the way, I don't give a flip about it. I don't care about that stuff. Just handle yourself. What's that? Sounds like Pilate, the washing of the hands. Yeah, yeah. Except that Pilate then goes on to still condemn. Here, Gallo basically says, get out of here. You're wasting my time. You know, dismisses him. Now, then all of them seized new guy, Sosthenes, official of the synagogue. I mean, you can't grab Paul, grab somebody else, you know, and beat him in front of the tribunal. And apparently the governor is okay with that. Gallio paid no attention, and he probably thought this is great, this little entertainment on Tuesday afternoon. Yeah, Luke tells us that the Jewish community tries to get Paul in trouble with Rome, which is why they haul him before Gallio. Now, this gets really interesting. On the one hand, Luke will go out of his way to whitewash anything that might look negative to Rome. We know that about Luke. He does it in the Gospel, and he does it in the Book of Acts. You know. Luke does not want to, again, who's Luke writing to? Yeah. And he writes to Theophilus, which could be a very high Roman official. So Gallo is one of what was called one of Luke's good Romans. Good Romans don't have any problem with Jesus, okay? In fact, no Roman ever finds fault with Paul. His conflicts in Luke are always with the Jews. Well, maybe. But we got Paul's letters, okay? The truth is slightly more complicated. Paul tells us that he got in trouble a little bit, you know? Remember this? Three times I was beaten with rods. Who's the only agency who does the rod beating? Rome. So at least three times, he didn't got in trouble with Jews. He got in trouble enough with Rome that he was beaten by the rods. We all also know that there are parts of Paul's gospel that would have put him at odds. Now, let's be honest. This is probably about the year 51 or so. So this is awfully early. We don't have systematic persecution of Christians. We don't have a lot of tension between Rome and the church at this point. But there are things that Paul could say that might, for example, a little background here. You remember Rome holds Caesar to be divine and living God to be worshipped. It's on the coins. Some of you have seen this. Caesar, divi, divine God. And sometimes divi filii, son of God, titles. It's on coins, it's on monuments, it's on temples, it's on inscriptions. Next week we're going to look at a couple of the inscriptions, like the Pyrene inscription. Worship of Caesar, and the Romans did not segregate church and state. The faith existed to prop up the state. You want to really have happy gods, because you don't want unhappy gods. because they might do things that would hurt, be detrimental to us. So what you really don't want is anybody ticking off the gods. Okay, so we want to placate the gods. And how do we do that? We need to make sacrifices. We need to do all those kinds of things. So in the Roman Empire, worship of Caesar, worship also of the of Rome, of Roma, was proof of being a good, loyal citizen. So, but if you didn't worship Caesar, that meant you were disloyal to Rome. So it carried a non-religious kind of thing of that. That's about the emperor cut. So now, part of the worship of Rome is calling God, Son of God, God, Lord, and Savior. We'll see the Pyrene inscription next week. All those titles are official titles of the Roman emperor, beginning with Augustus Caesar. Can you imagine that an occasional Christian might have an issue with this and might not want to do that? And as a matter of fact, we have some evidence in Paul's letters that he's not seeking conflict with Rome, but some of his message Romans might take offense at. So let's look at a few of these. For us, yes. It's not so much a kneel down. Well, what the Romans did is that the Romans were not monotheists. So basically, you could worship any god you want. And you could worship as many gods you want. They had no problem with that. What they had a problem with is not including in that worship of Caesar's dignity, worshiping Roma, the goddess Roma, and worshiping those gods that Romans thought are the ones who have enabled us to have the success that we've had. So, and you go out and worship 45 more gods, no problems. But, and it was a public ceremony. These are things you did in public. You went out, and these are outdoor worship areas, and you come, you make your sacrifice to the emperor. Later in the second century, we get lots of stories of where you have to do that, and you have to have a sheet of paper that says that you did that so that you can show it so you don't get in trouble. If you don't have the paper, you can get all kinds of trouble. And many of those have actually been found in Egypt. And we have surviving examples of those. But at this point, there's no evidence that it's more this, you know, it's like a person refuses to say the Pledge of Allegiance or put their hand over it. You know, it's things that people, other people look at and go, you know. Yeah, it's disrespectful and it's not being, you know, respectful of who we are as a nation. That kind of thing, but more. Because it was really religious. The gods. We want the gods on our side. We do not want to tick off the gods. That's how you really get in trouble. And if George over here is not giving the gods their due, I've got an issue with George. In the year 117, we have an Asian Minor. Pliny the Younger is a governor in Bithynia. And he has a letter that he writes to the Emperor Trajan. And there's a whole correspondence about this, which is just over the issue of, yeah, you know, you can't do that. You know, if you'll just in public, do the thing with Caesar and do the thing with the goddess Roma. Worship whatever you want. We got no problem with that. But you need to do your civic obligation here. And the issue here, well, how about this? For us, there's one God. Is that an issue? Okay. The Father, from whom things, you also begin to see the beginning of the Creed here, the Apostles' Creed, okay? And then he goes on, and one Lord, Jesus Christ. But remember that Lord is a title for Caesar, okay? Through him all things. And again, you see the Nicene Creed in this. It's interesting. Philippians, he says this, our citizenship is in heaven. Well, them is fighting words, you know? And it is from there that we are expecting a Savior. One of the titles of Caesar, beginning with Augustus Caesar, because Augustus Caesar ended the long civil war that tore the Roman Empire apart. He is Savior. And for somebody else to be a Savior, you know, and he's Lord, that's that title. So, 1 Corinthians 2:8, we have this. None of the rulers of this age understand this. If they had, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. That's skating on some thin ice. So, no evidence that Paul was attacking Rome, But is there evidence that some of his theology could have been viewed as a little bit problematic? Okay. In Acts, the Jews attempt to get Paul in trouble with the Roman authorities. They fail. Galileo rules the dispute as an internal Jewish affair. So likely at this point, that's Galileo's description is probably dead on. That at this point, a Roman governor would not have a lot really to work with to see that we have anything. It just is. Do you remember that the Jewish faith was protected by Roman law? By Julius Caesar? I went and re-researched this, and by Augustus Caesar. I thought it was Augustus Caesar. It goes back to Julius. Romans loved antiquity. So any religion that existed prior to the founding of Rome, 700 B.C., was to be respected with integrity. Any newer religion was not tolerated. Okay? The Jews went back to when? Moses. So, and there were actually some like with Herod and stuff, there were some key Jerusalem officials, ruling officials, who actually, like Herod, grew up in the court with Augustus Caesar. So they knew that. So the Jews, and they weren't alone, but they're the main ones, they got a buy. You don't have to worship Rome. You don't have to worship Caesar as Jews. Now, as long as Christians are operating within the Jewish arena, they're okay. What happens when somebody suddenly says, ooh, they're not Jews, they're Christians? You don't get a buy. Okay. It's only when the faith becomes clearly identified with something other than Jewish that the conflict runs through. Likely, for the most part, this is after Paul is gone. This is the latter. And that'll get you into the book of Revelation and where Rome is the devil on earth. See, Sosthenes, 1 Corinthians confirms that Sosthenes is a disciple. This confirmed there. And there's a lot of debate whether Sosthenes is actually another name for one of the other people. Remember Crispus? Crispus and Sosthenes, there's some debate. I don't know where it comes from, but that they're the same. So, Paul briefly travels from Jerusalem to Antioch. Now, we're going to kind of focus on this for just a second because it's a real interesting piece. Remember the green is where he kind of wandered over? And he winds up at Corinth. Well, all of a sudden, we've got him going back to Jerusalem and then going up to Syria, and then he's going to come back again. After staying in Ephesus for a considerable time, Paul said farewell to the believers. He sailed for Syria, accompanied by Prisca and Aquila. They go with him. At Cenchreae, he had his hair cut. This is not just a haircut. This is a Jew having his hair cut. Because he was under a vow. Remember the Nazarene vow? You grow your hair until the vow is fulfilled. You do it in the temple. You cut your hair. Okay. First he went to the synagogue, had a discussion with the Jews. They asked him to stay longer. Interesting. He declined. He said, I will return to you if God wills. He set sail from Ephesus, landed at Caesarea, went up to Jerusalem because it's uphill. He greeted the church. Remember, they love him there. Remember that? James and the brothers. You gotta love this. I mean, how big a deal is it to get in a ship and do this? Only be to said he went to Jerusalem, he greeted the church, and he left. I'm thinking there's something not being said there, okay? After spending some time, he went to Antioch, spent some time there, he departed. Luke does not mention a single thing that happened in Jerusalem or a single thing that happens in Antioch. That is significant. Then he returns through Galatia, Persia, back, strengthening the disciples. Now, traditionally, this red trip is understood to be the end of the second journey, and then the green part, coming back home, is understood to be the beginning of the third journey. A lot of scholars today would say that's not how Luke depicts it. Luke depicts it more as a big, long journey with a brief interlude to go home and come back. It doesn't look like he's, you know, it's not a major transition in the book of Acts. And then we have all this stuff, you know, probably it's a Nazarite vow. We don't know that, but we know a Nazarite vow can only be completed in the temple, so maybe that's what he did in Jerusalem. Nazarite vow, you know, goes back to the book of Numbers, so you have to do that in the temple. Paul does not mention it, but Paul mentions in other places that that he does still see him. Remember, he doesn't see the Jews as being under the Jewish law or the Gentiles, but he understands himself to be under the Jewish law. So you'll say this in Romans, did we overthrow the law by thy faith? By no means. On the contrary, we uphold the law, speaking by itself. Paul also says that he's willing to follow Jewish regulations if it helped his relationship with other Jews. So in Corinthians, he says this, to the Jews, I became a Jew in order to win Jews. So he's not against the Jewish tradition. I'm going to kind of fast forward through this real quick. The vow does demonstrate that Paul has a willingness to follow the Torah in terms of his own personal spirituality. He is a Jew. This would, if he did this for this purpose, it would show to the people in Jerusalem, some of whom do not like Paul, that he is Torah observant Jew. And it's exactly what you would expect. And here's the speculation. This is scholarly speculation. Not knowing why he went back, the scholar can drive a truck through that, right? Okay. Why did Paul go back? The consensus is, what would make sense, if Paul went back to Jerusalem and Antioch, why those two places? Well, those are the two places who've turned on him. If he could go back and mend the relationship, that would be wonderful. And we know, Paul doesn't go alone. So if he fails, it's kind of a private thing, which is good. Luke passes over this. He only greets the church. We're not told anything about this in either place. Luke implies that the relationship is there. We know from Paul that he's estranged from Jerusalem. He's estranged from Antioch. The relationships are probably hostile. We're going to kind of end with this. Paul tells us in the letter some interesting things. Paul says there are brothers. Who would those be? Who's a brother for Paul? Fellow Christians. Aren't super apostles in Jerusalem who continue to follow him around. So let's just end with this. A few quotes from Paul. This is how loving his relationship is with Jerusalem and with Antioch. 2 Corinthians. I am not in the least inferior to these super apostles. Which means the super apostles are saying what? He is inferior. Okay? I am not inferior to these super apostles. Again, different quotation, same thing. I have been in danger from false brothers and sisters. Other Christians, okay? 2 Corinthians, for they say, his letters are weighty and strong, but his bodily presence is weak. Just take a stab at him, okay? And his speech, contemptible. These are your friends, you think, maybe. Philippians, he says this, beware of the dogs, beware of the evil workers, beware of those who mutilate the flesh, the ones who want his disciples to do that. In Galatians, he says this, as we have said before, so I now repeat, if anyone proclaims to you a gospel contrary to what you received, let him be accursed. And you remember what he says next? May the knife slip while they're doing their circumcision. Okay. He did say that. Okay. It is those who want to make a good showing in the flesh who try to compel you to be circumcised. We got brothers, we got super apostles from Jerusalem. We'll end with this. They are systematically following Paul everywhere he goes, undermining everything he does. Now, does that hurt you? Does that hurt what you're doing? If you could go back to Jerusalem and Antioch and mend those fences, would that be beneficial to your ministry? Consensus is that's the most likely reason we'd know. Doesn't work. Luke does not mention anything. Paul does not mention anything. Most likely it failed because guess what? Some of these things I just read to you are after this, not before. So the critique will continue. Paul will then return. He's going to go back to Ephesus. In the next 2.5 years, he's going to be operating there. And next week, we will have that.